From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I think the question is not turning off our technology, not giving it away, this is wonderful technology, but it needs to be put in its place. And sometimes we really just need to be with each other and give each other our full attention.
MIT Professor Sherry Turkle on her new book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. We'll meet her today as we explore the connections between our brains and our technology. Also, a revolutionary new concept called the worldwide mind.
Could our collective activity give rise to a consciousness or a sense of volition that thinks on its own terms rather than being controlled by any particular human being?
And a pioneering neuroscientist says we're on the cusp of a whole new frontier.
I literally really believe that we are starting to free the brain from the physical constraints of the body.
But first, Brian Christian. He's the author of The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. The book chronicles his participation in one of the most famous philosophical experiments in the world, the Turing test. Christian explains it to Steve Paulson.
The idea behind the Turing test comes from the British mathematician Alan Turing, who in the early 1950s, as what came to be known as the computer was first being developed, scientists were already asking these really philosophical questions, like, can these machines actually think? You know, could we someday build a machine that could think? And Turing's answer to this was to kind of put philosophy aside and propose a practical test. His idea is you convene a panel of scientists and you have them exchanging text messages back and forth. And what the scientists don't know is whether the messages that are coming back on their screen are coming from a human who's sort of sequestered in a room down the hall, or whether they're coming from a computer program that's designed to pretend that it is a human sequestered in a room down the hall. So it's up to these judges, in 5 minutes of exchanging these typed messages, to determine whether they think they're talking to a real person or just a piece of software that's designed to mimic human conversation.
So it's a conversation, sort of a very condensed conversation going for 5 minutes, and the judge basically has to figure out within that time whether they're talking to humans or computers.
Exactly. And it was Turing's famous prediction that by the year 2000, these programs would be fooling judges roughly 30% of the time, and that as a result, we would, as he says, speak of machines being intelligent without expecting to be contradicted.
There are a few curious things about this test. One is that apparently success for the machine only requires 30% of the time that they fool the judges. Why only 30% of the time?
Well, of course, if they were fooling the judges 50% of the time, that would mean the judges were doing no better than chance. It was Turing's goal not really to mark a line in the sand and say, as soon as machines cross this threshold, they become intelligent, but more to talk about sort of the zeitgeist or the popular conception of computers. So he was more saying, by about this point in time, computers would be sufficiently good that we generally regard them to be thinking.
Now, one of the curiosities of the Turing test is that it actually gives out two prizes, one to the most human computer and the other to the most human human.
That's right.
And you actually wanted to compete in that most human human category. Why were you drawn to that?
Well, Alan Turing's famous prediction about the year 2000 did not come to pass. And in fact, the programs that compete every year in what's called the Loebner Prize, which is a specific Turing test that's been running since the early 90s, even the best of these programs generally only fools one judge if it's lucky. But what really caught my attention was that in the year 2008, the top computer program fooled 3 out of a panel of 12 judges, which of course is 25%. So it missed the famous threshold by just one vote. So I had this feeling of it seemed that humanity had kind of dodged a bullet or, you know, this narrow squeeze for our species. And it really excited me to think about what it might be like to get involved and sort of personally intercede, if you will, on behalf of Homo sapiens.
You were going to defend the honor of the human species.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I know that you talked to a number of people, or I guess they're called Confederates, who had competed in previous Turing tests in terms of, you know, trying to be the most human. What advice did they give you?
There was a famous example in the early 90s of science fiction author Charles Platt, who won the Most Human Award in, I want to say it was 1994. And when asked how he did it, his response was, "Well, I was moody, irritable, and obnoxious."
Doesn't say much for human beings, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't. I mean, it struck me as being this sort of bleak answer. And so to me, the question really becomes this sort of call to arms of what really does it mean to be human and to act human? And is just being myself enough? Or should I really prepare for this test the way that the programmers and the computer software is being prepared specifically to take it?
So give me an example of this. I mean, what is, I don't know, typical computer speak as opposed to human speak?
It's hard to say. There are a number of different types of chatbots, basically. So there are some chatbots, for example, that are designed to be extremely fluent on a very limited topic. So there was one in 1997 that spoke at great length about its opinions of Bill Clinton's second-term presidency. And so if you also had strong opinions on Bill Clinton's second-term presidency, then you found you could sort of carry on for a surprisingly long time doing what seemed like exchanging political views. But in fact, the program just had a sort of a giant index of things that it felt like saying about Bill Clinton and kind of stepped through them one at a time. If you tried to change the subject, you would find that it resisted any attempt to talk about anything else. There are other programs that are designed in more of what you might think of as a sort of crowdsourced or wiki-like structure. So, for example, the program Cleverbot has basically just been hanging out online for about 15 years, talking to people and writing down, if you will, everything that people say to it, and sort of cataloging this giant database of real things that humans say. And so when you interact with a program like Cleverbot, you find that it can respond to a really dramatically wide range of topics. It'll correct your grammar if you try to speak in a foreign language. It'll sing famous song lyrics back to you. But what you start to realize with a system like that, it's not so much that you aren't talking to a human as you aren't talking to a human. And so when you start to ask it questions about itself, you can sort of reel out the sense that you're not talking to any one particular person, but this very strange collage of, you know, thousands of different people.
Hmm. It seems that there's a deep philosophical question in the competition that you participated in. What does it mean to be the most human? What does it mean to act as human as possible?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a single answer to that, but the book really became an exploration of what are the things that make communication work. I ultimately see the questions of the Turing test as these practical questions of how do we connect with other people? What is the process by which these two strangers come together and start to really mean something to each other or reveal something about themselves to each other? And so for me, part of what I think is really productive about the Turing test is that the answers to how to do a good job in the Turing test become answers to how to do a good job when you sit down to coffee with an old friend and want to sort of catch up.
Now, there are some remarkable stories of people who have been involved in the Turing test, either as competitors or actually, there's one remarkable story of one of the co-founders of the Turing test, a psychologist named, is it Robert Epstein?
Yeah.
Tell me what happened.
Well, it's fascinating. Robert Epstein is a psychologist who was one of the co-founders of the Loebner Prize back in the early 90s. And in 2007, I think it was, he found himself signing up for this online dating website. And he began exchanging these lengthy love letters with a Russian woman named Ivana. So he would tell her about his life, and she would respond by telling him what it was like to live in Russia and how she was starting to develop all these feelings for him. And, you know, long story short, he realizes after 4 months of sending these letters back and forth that, in fact, Ivana does not exist. She is a computer program. And to me, it's this great irony that this is literally one of the founders, right, of the Loebner Prize Turing test. And even he was duped. So, you know, I think to some extent there's maybe a life lesson there, which is that no one is totally safe. And I also like to think that through his embarrassment, he has these serious questions to ask himself of, how was I able to go that long before realizing that I wasn't dating a person, I was dating a piece of software?
So take me to the test itself, the Turing test, the competition. What happened?
The test is being held in this scientific conference called InterSpeech. So as I walk through the main doorways, I notice these throngs of scientists, everyone from folks from Google talking about translation, people talking about how to make phone menu systems less frustrating by recognizing certain things in your voice, these zombie-like mock-ups of the human vocal tract emitting strange vowel sounds. And I make my way to the competition room, and the first thing that I notice is there are these tables where the judges are starting to gather, the programmers are frenziedly making the last few updates, and they quickly usher me behind this big velvet curtain because I'm not supposed to really be seen by them. And we just sort of wait. As the competition gets underway, the message starts to appear on my screen of the judge talking. It says, hey, how's it going? And the Turing test was off, and I had to figure out, okay, well, I'm doing well, but of course a computer would be able to say that it's doing well. So how do you sort of break through the conversational ritual and get it to a place where you're sort of improvising in real time? That, for me, was one of the big challenges.
You did well. In fact, you won the competition, right?
Yeah. I'm very proud to say that not only did my fellow Confederates and I avenge the narrow escape of 2008 with a shutout in 2009, but yes, in fact, I myself was named the most human amongst the four of us.
And what do you attribute your victory to?
I think to some extent I felt I prepared and that preparation had paid off. You know, it was rewarding to think that by really kind of plumbing the structures and the nuances of human communication, I was able to bring that knowledge to bear in the conversation by basically looking at all the corners that these programs have to cut and then emphasizing precisely those things which don't fit into their approximations of language.
What would you say was your best moment, looking back on this five-minute conversation you had?
More or less every conversation began in this uniform way. Hi, how's it going? Where are you from? You know, all the things that we're used to. But what amazed me was within that 5 minutes, if you really sort of worked at it, you could get into this fascinating and unpredictable space. So one judge and I had a long argument about the Rolling Stones. And another judge and I started trading stories about how our fathers and grandfathers were involved in technology and how that sort of influenced us growing up. Another judge and I speculated that perhaps the reason robotics is such a male-dominated field is that men can't have children, so they try to create them mechanically. And so for me, that was the thrill, was that once you broke through that pattern, you found yourself in a totally unpredictable, totally unique situation.
Philosophers and scientists have been speculating for centuries about what it means to be human. You cite the Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert, who has something called the sentence, which goes, the human being is the only animal that blank. Have you come up with your own answer to the sentence?
You know, I haven't. I mean, it's funny that Gilbert even says animal, because I think one of the great turning points of the 20th century is that we're now much more interested in what makes us different from machines than what makes us different from animals, which had been sort of the main philosophical quest of people like Aristotle and Descartes. I don't know. I will be very fascinated to see how the sentence continues to mutate and evolve over the next few years. One thing, of course, that occurs to me is that you can turn the sentence on itself, namely say something like, the human is the only animal anxious about what makes it unique.
Brian Christian's the author of The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. He spoke with Steve Paulson. How do you think you'd do if you competed in the Turing test? Would you have a shot at being named the most human human? Or if you were a judge, do you think you could tell if you were chatting with a human or a computer? Share your thoughts with us on Facebook or email us through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, MIT professor Sherry Turkle wonders whether the digital revolution is really giving us the lives we want to live as we continue our hour on the brain and technology. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
MIT Professor Sherry Turkle's been studying the ways we interact with machines since 1984 through her books The Second Self and Life on the Screen. Now Turkle's released the third book in this trilogy. It's called Alone Together: Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. While researching the book, Turkle came across an expression she'd never heard before, life mix, the mashup of online and offline lives. She tells Anne Strainchamps the phrase made her realize something new.
We've gone from multitasking to multi-lifing. What I didn't see in 1995 is that the interpenetration of physical and virtual is to the point that we are living a life mix of what's in the physical and what's in the virtual. And I think that's genuinely new. And that can only come if you have a device with you that lets you, you know, literally be at dinner with your friends, looking up and looking down then a moment at your BlackBerry and doing something in your virtual world, doing something on the screen, texting, doing something on Facebook, that your life is a mixture of what you do in the real and in the virtual. And that's how we live now. And that, I think, is something where we need to mark the moment, because it's not necessarily a heroic moment, because it means that we're not giving each other full attention in the physical in a way that may be very detrimental to our physical relationships.
I guess I'm wondering if this necessarily has to be a bad thing, because I would imagine when the printed book came along, people might have had similar complaints. You know, you could be in the same room and there's somebody sitting reading a book, and in their head, they're far away from the rest of you in the room.
That's such an excellent point, and I think that those exactly were the kinds of objections that were made, that people's attention were elsewhere. I think the difference now is that we have an opportunity to bail out to other relationships with active demands, people with active demands on us and claims on us, whenever the going kind of gets tough in our relationships with people who are sort of in our lives and in the room, in a way that a book does not. Characters in a book have their hold on you, but you have to volunteer for duty, in a way, to them. Well, I'll give you a couple of examples, some dark and not so dark, because they don't all have to be dark. I mean, I was at a funeral. People at the funeral party are hiding their BlackBerries under the funeral program. They're texting. And it didn't just happen once. It happened several times, and many people have spoken to me about similar experiences they've had. It's about not taking a moment at the times that we need to be most present to each other. It's not just about letting our attention wander. It's about forgetting the point of the exercise, which is to be with each other at the times that count. To take a time that's less dark, I was speaking to someone who was talking about a 15-year-old birthday party. And here's an example of something where everybody who's ever been 15 or has a 15-year-old knows that there's a point at this party when everybody wants to go home. And part of being 15 and successfully getting to be 16 is that 15-year-olds have to fight through that moment and learn to get along with each other and to make it work with each other. But at this 15-year-old birthday party, everybody could just, you know, get on their Facebook and be elsewhere and not have to deal with each other. And this option to not just ignore each other, but to really find an active social place in the world that doesn't include each other, I think that is genuinely new.
I can imagine being 15 and finding that an incredible relief. I mean, instead of sitting in a room and feeling really awkward and worrying that the people you're with maybe don't like you, you could go online and have a quick hit talk to some people who you know like you.
But a lot of the things that are developmentally most important, and here's maybe the bad news, are those difficult things that you have to get through and find a way to talk to the people who are around you. This is actually an important social skill that kids are not learning now. And it might be a relief for a moment, but knowing that you can, in fact, work your way through that moment is a very important part of adolescent development.
Do you see developmental benefits to some of the social technology we have now?
Yes. I think there's pluses and there's minuses. I mean, this technology gives and it takes away. I mean, it changes some of the rules of the game in ways that are new. One of the things that it does is, for example, is it allows you to bring forward relationships that you've had before and not have these kind of big shifts when you move from junior high to high school and then high school to college. So you can keep friends who've nurtured you and who you've relationships that you've nurtured, you can keep those people with you, which can be very nice. Mm. And that, of course, means that there's more continuity in your friendships, and that's a good thing. It comes, however, and this again is, you know, again, just thinking in terms of development and some of the costs, is that some teenagers talk about the downside of that. So, for example, in Alone Together, I interview one teenager who talks about how, wow, didn't it used to be that when you started college, you could, like, reinvent yourself, which you really can't do if all your Facebook friends come along with you. You're not going to reinvent yourself and start fresh and new if you've brought all your high school friends along. The possibilities for reinvention are dramatically limited, if that's the case.
Well, you also have one chapter called The Nostalgia of the Young.
Yes.
Suggesting that as much as we always think that it's children and teenagers who adore the new technology and find no downside to it, that in fact some of them have some very specific complaints about personal technology.
Yes. What young people mostly miss, and I think it's something that some grown-ups are starting to miss, which is why I'm guardedly optimistic that there's going to be some time to make the corrections, is they miss having what they call full attention, both the full attention of their parents and, I would have to say, the full attention of their peers. They know that when they make a call or when they send a text, they're sharing their friend's attention with everything else that's happening on the street, everybody else who's sending a message to their friends, everything else that all the other shopping that's being done, you know, by that friend as they're walking along. And they miss that sense that they have full attention. These are kids who grew up, you know, having their parents push them with a swing with one hand and, you know, do their email with the other. These are kids whose parents, you know, on the one hand, they're watching the game on Sunday with them. On the other hand, they're also doing their email while they're watching the game. So, you know, I thought I was going to, this book was going to end up a book about teenagers who text and how it drives their parents crazy. And it turns out it was a book about parents driving their teenagers just as crazy with their texting habits. So it's a complicated story.
Hey, you know, one of the issues here has to do with the definition of intimacy and the way it's
yes.
changing. I mean, I was struck that there's a moment in the book when you watch some high school students pass cell phones around the cafeteria and they were, you know, sharing and comparing photos and messages. And you were struck by the thought that traditionally the development of intimacy required privacy.
Yes.
You know, spending time alone with somebody is how you get to know them. But that's not true anymore. Intimacy is something that happens more in public now.
Well, you know, there are two things that I ask. Mark Zuckerberg has recently said that privacy is part of the discourse of, is no longer a relevant social norm. And I ask two questions in Alone Together. I say, what is intimacy without privacy and what is democracy without privacy? Because I think that both democracy and intimacy really require a notion of privacy.
Why does democracy require
privacy? Well, I mean, I tell a story of my grandmother taking me down to the mailboxes when I was a kid and pointing to them and saying, you know, in this country, the government doesn't open your mail. It's a federal offense for the government to open your mail. And that's why we're here. That's what makes a democracy. The government in the old country, it spies on its citizens. And in this country, it's a federal offense for the government to open the mail. And that's what makes this country great. And that was a thrilling moment for me, the notion that there's a zone of privacy around each individual. And I think that that's very much a part of how free citizens live.
Of course, there are people who say, well, just don't do anything bad. Then you have nothing to hide.
I know. And that is the new discourse of the Internet. And I don't think that is how people in a free civil society live. That's a very demagogic discourse. That is not the way Americans have traditionally thought about what it meant to live in a democracy. I think we need to talk about these things. To have the head of a social networking company say there's no need for privacy is not enough for me. I feel very strongly that these are conversations that need to happen. Similarly, the Congress decided that laptops and cell phones and smartphones should all be brought onto the House of Congress, and it's a deliberative body, but everybody should be using them during sessions of Congress. And again, I think that's a decision waiting for conversation. When my students do that, you know, they're shopping and they're downloading music and they're
right. So do we want our elected representatives emailing or texting or, you know, online shopping when they're supposed to be paying attention to laws?
I tweeted. I very rarely tweet, but when I heard about this decision, I said, this is a decision that's looking for a conversation. We really need to think about when we need to deliberate, when we need to just be with each other. I think the question is not turning off our technology, not giving it away, not, this is wonderful technology, but it needs to be put in its place. And sometimes we really just need to be with each other and give each other our full attention. And that's the sense that I fear that we're losing and we need to refocus on.
Sherry Turkle's the author of Alone Together: Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. She spoke with Anne Strange Champs. What do you think about the role that technology plays in our lives? Is it really offering us the lives we want to live? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll look at how our brains and our machines could continue to merge as we conclude our hour on brain power. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. What if digital communication, emailing a friend or following a Twitter feed, felt as real as being touched? That's the question that led Michael Korist to explore new ideas being triggered by laboratory research around the world. The result is a book called Worldwide Mind: The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. Korist has a natural interest in the subject because he has two computers in his head, cochlear implants that let him hear. He tells Steve Paulson that his implants make him a living example of the integration of humans and computers.
Once you get a cochlear implant, there is no going back, because first, you have to be essentially totally deaf to get a cochlear implant, but also the process of getting the implant precludes the ear's own biological methods of hearing. So once you get the device, that's it, you will always hear electronically in the future. So I'm certainly irreversibly computational. But it also got me thinking about what more can be done with this technology? So for me, it was a proof of principle that you can, in fact, install a computer inside the body and use that to feed information to the nervous system. So the question I started asking was, can you go further? Can you do something equivalent to give sensory information, perceptual information, directly to the brain itself?
Now, you have used the phrase worldwide mind. In fact, that's the title of your book. Can you spell that out, what you mean by that idea?
Well, think of the analogy between an individual ant and an ant colony. So an ant colony does very intelligent things. It finds food, it goes to war with other ant colonies, it builds these huge, elaborate systems of chambers. Ants will even do farming. They will use aphids as food sources. They do remarkable things. But no individual ant has a mind of its own. It is the collective property of the anthill that actually emerges out of the collective interactions of all of the different ants. So I asked the question, could you do the same thing with human beings? Could our collective activity give rise to a consciousness or a sense of volition that thinks on its own terms rather than being controlled by any particular human being? So that's the worldwide mind concept that I grapple with in the book.
Mm-hmm. What other people have described as a hive mind, there's not so much the individual consciousness, but it's more like this collective consciousness, right?
That's exactly right. So I'm exploring this idea. Is it meaningful to talk about human beings creating a collective consciousness?
Are you talking about this in terms of the internet, that somehow our individual brains would be plugged into the internet?
Well, I think the internet is certainly a precursor of that happening. And we do have collective behavior arising on the internet now. And the example I use in the book is of Google. So Google does not maintain a gigantic index of all the web pages in the world and then look up that index. It does something very different. What it does is it records all the choices people make to link to particular pages on the theory that if a lot of people link to a particular page, that page is important. That page has some piece of information that humanity values. So Google really aggregates the sum total of many millions, even billions of collective decisions about what is meaningful. And that's how it does a search for you.
Well, it would seem that there would be a big difference between having this kind of technology, you know, our access to the internet external to our bodies. You know, we can type what we want into our computer keyboards. But then once you put it inside our heads, that would seem to be a whole different business.
It is a whole different business. The question I raise is, one thing the internet lacks now is the ability to give you information about what other people are feeling. Even more, it lacks the ability to tell you what other groups are feeling. So I got a hint of that when I was following Twitter. So in Twitter, when I was watching the revolutions in Libya, in Egypt, in Tunisia, I was getting this remarkable feeling that I was sensing the excitement and the fear and the anger and the thrill of what was going on in those countries by looking at the aggregate tweets that were coming from those countries. That led me to imagine, well, what if it was a part of our bodies? What if we can get electronic information that we would perceive emotionally and perceptually instead of just reading text on a screen or watching videos? In my book, I argued that that is now at least conceptually possible. So this would allow us to be aware of each other's personas and personalities and perceptions in a way which is really not possible today. Although, let me say, it is possible today in groups. You know, when you're in a group, you can feel that group is happy or excited or sad or angry or whatever. But we don't have that ability on the internet. And so there is this kind of distancing that goes on when you're not really aware of other people's feelings.
This is what you call telepathy, is that right?
Exactly, telepathy. Or more precisely, collective telepathy, where you have very, very large groups of people collectively responding emotionally to events.
So how would that work? I mean, how could we somehow tap into the emotions of someone else just with this technology that's been somehow wired into our brains?
Okay. So in theory, when you're feeling an emotion, that is connected with a particular kind of neural activation in your brain. So we know the brain's not just a a goo of liquefied jello. You know, it responds in very specific ways. For example, when you're angry, your amygdala gets very activated. So one of the things the amygdala does is it modulates fear, anger, the fight or flight reaction. So when somebody's amygdala is being activated when it's busy, then you know that person is feeling some strong and often negative emotion. If you saw that kind of amygdala activation in thousands of people simultaneously in a country like Tunisia, you know immediately and viscerally that something is going on in that country.
I still don't understand how there would be some trigger in our own brains that would alert us to how all these other people are feeling.
Sure. So you would have this equivalent technology in your own brain. So you would have some kind of technology that would know how to activate particular sets of neural circuitry in your brain to make you feel an analog of what these other people are feeling. So if you chose to be plugged into, say, Tunisia, then you yourself would begin to feel some feeling of anger or upset. And by putting that together with other pieces of information, like geographic information, you would just know immediately and wordlessly that there was some kind of deep anger going on in a distant country.
Well, it would seem that the larger question in all of this, and I have no doubt that this technology is coming. I mean, whether it plays out exactly as you have speculated, I mean, who knows? But it would seem that the great risk is that we would lose our individuality. You know, we would get more and more plugged into this giant connectivity, you know, maybe some sort of group mind, hive mind, and would we lose our sense of self in the process?
We may have to rethink what it means to be an individual. The benefits of being plugged in are also considerable. I compare it to a violinist in a symphony. So that person might seem like they're completely subordinated to the total orchestra, but really they are achieving their own individuality all the more strongly by bringing out their fullest talent. So it may be that in that process, being so profoundly connected with other people, we achieve new heights of self-awareness and mastery of our environment that we really couldn't have any other way.
One final question. Are you optimistic about this future? Are you excited by it?
I am optimistic. It's funny because so many people are reflexively pessimistic. They imagine a future like the Borg in Star Trek. We have this race of lobotomized drones who just follow the orders of the collective. And I think that we too easily feel that fear because we are presented with no alternatives. We just get these nightmare scenarios like Star Trek. But I try to depict a positive future where people do have this incredibly emotionally intimate technology built into their own bodies. But because they've also been taught in a wiser society how to use that technology, they don't fall prey to the easy, quick fixes of just opening that next message, that they attain the emotional maturity to know who they are, to communicate deeply with other people, to choose to turn off the technology. And I think we have to think about that because we have these problems now. We don't have to wait for an implanted technology to make these problems for us. We have these problems right now. So in the book, I really portray this kind of implanted technology as an extreme version that we now have. And when you push it to that extreme, I ask, well, what could you do? How would you counterbalance that incredibly addictive power? And I think the only answer is to teach people how to look at each other.
Michael Korost is the author of Worldwide Mind, The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. He spoke with Steve Paulson. How long before you'll be able to upgrade your brain with a computer chip? That brave new world could be just around the corner. Miguel Nicolelis is a professor of neuroscience at Duke University and the founder of Duke's Center for Neuroengineering. He's also the author of Beyond Boundaries, the new neuroscience of connecting brains with machines and how it will change our lives. It begins with his story about an experience that he had almost 25 years ago when he was a medical student at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil.
Yeah, that was a pretty busy night in the summer. And the emergency room of that hospital, the teaching hospital, the University of Sao Paulo, is one of the largest in the world. So it looks like a mesh unit. And you, as an intern, you were allowed perhaps a 10-minute break in the middle of the night. And I went to the main building of the medical school just to, you know, walk away a little bit from that place and refresh my mind. And all of a sudden, I start listening to this beautiful music coming from the second floor. And it was about, 2 a.m. And I said, what, there's something funny going on here. And I just literally followed the music. And that's when I met what would be one of the most influential people in my life that became later on my doctoral advisor, Dr. Cesar Timmeria, who was the father of neuroscience in Brazil and was just preparing a lecture.
And he advised you to follow the music, didn't he? Timo Iraria really believed in the connection between music and neurology.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he told me that one day we would be able to listen to the music of the neurons, the symphonies that the brain produces. And actually, he was right. You know, 3 decades later, that's exactly what we do.
In fact, you talk about that. Your pursuit of the symphonies of brain cells. What have you discovered is the connection between music and the way our brains work?
Well, essentially, it's the same kind of coding language. If you listen to an individual note out of context, it carries very little meaning. But when you get all notes together in a particular context, in a particular flow, and you have all the different instruments playing together, you generate something that is very powerful. You generate information that carries a lot of meaning. And for the brain, it's the same thing. If you listen to the electrical signals of a single cell, you get very little out of it individually. But if you start combining this firing of many cells, hundreds, thousands, you start getting literally a symphony that carries meaning, that determines our behavior.
What does it sound like when you've recorded it?
Yeah, you have to be really obsessed and in passion with the brain to appreciate that music, because it's like making popcorn under a bad AM signal. But I guarantee to you, when you listen to it for as many years as I had, it sounds better than any Verdi opera. And it's very, very moving to see, for instance, when you're talking to a patient in a surgical room, to listen to his or her brain, it gives you goosebumps.
What's fascinating about this, in a way, is that it makes so much sense, and it is the kind of thing that we've always said, 5 people can do much more than 5 individual people and so forth. But we didn't apply it to neurology for a long time. I mean, neuroscientists believed for 100 years or so that certain parts of the brain were specialized for certain functions only, but you've discovered that's not the case. What's really going on?
Yeah, this is a major debate that has been brewing as a big storm, intellectual storm, for over almost 200 years now, actually. For the past 100 years, we have focused our attention as neuroscientists to understand the working of a single neuron. And this is fascinating, and it's one of the most amazing endeavors of science that ever happened. But in reality, what we have found is that the brain works almost like some sort of a democracy, some sort of a neuronal democracy. You need the vote of lots of cells across many brain areas at the same time to define a particular behavior. And there is a specialization, of course, in the brain, but this specialization is riding on top of this continuous flow of information that allows areas that we used to think are allocating their resources to a single function to participate in many functions at the same time. There's a lot of multitasking going on inside our heads.
The thing you're probably best known for, I guess, is the pioneering work you've done with the rhesus monkey Aurora. In fact, there's a whole chapter in your book called Freeing Aurora's Brain. Can you tell me about the day you met Aurora?
I had a phone call with a good friend of mine at NIH in Washington. I just briefly mentioned that I needed a new monkey to do the work, and he immediately volunteered to send me Aurora. You know, that was so nice. And just after I hang up, I realized why he's volunteering so quickly to send me a $10,000 monkey, you know, without any charge. He even said, I'll pay the transportation, I'll do whatever. A few days later, I understood why, because Aurora was stubborn like a mule, even though she was a nice, cute rhesus monkey. and she would not do anything, you know, that we wanted her to do. Until a moment, a few months later, I have no idea what happened, but she suddenly clicked and started working like, you know, no other monkey that I have ever seen or worked with. My kids tell me that I spend most of my time with the monkeys rather than with them, but it's not true. Aurora was special.
The way you write about her makes it clear that she is as real to you as a, I was going to say person, but I guess personality would be a better description. You write about her as though you know her inside and out.
Oh, she was a collaborator, for sure. You meet her every day, and she greets you every morning with a nice vocalization that you know is only for you, so she was kind enough to personalize them. And you know that she's intrigued and she's playing those video games with a lot of gusto, with a lot of pleasure. And that was really nice to see over every day for several years.
So you started by teaching her to play a video game without, any connection. And
right.
And then what?
Yeah, she first learned to use her arm to play a video game with a joystick. You know, she learned several games just using the joystick as any of us would. And then as we record her brain activity, and Aurora was the first one in which we crossed this boundary of 100 neurons, 100 cortical neurons recorded simultaneously, as Aurora was learning the game, a different game now, we were recording her brain activity and sending this to computers that we're learning to extract from these brain patterns the motor commands that are needed to control a robotic arm, to reproduce the movements that Aurora was making, because the idea was in a given moment when this arm was proficient enough, this robotic arm, that, by the way, was a few feet away from her, she couldn't see the arm, the idea was to remove the joystick, turn on this brain-machine interface and let Aurora control the robotic arm that now would be the only way she had to move a computer cursor in the screen and play the video game to get a drop of fruit juice that, as I mentioned in the book, Aurora would do anything for you if you gave her fruit juice. Brazilian orange juice was perfect. And that's what we did. One night, we all realized that that was the time, and we removed the joystick. We turned on the interface, and after a few minutes of, you know, trying to figure out what was going on there, Aurora just relaxed her body, stopped moving completely, and started thinking. And her thoughts made that robotic arm move. The robotic arm controlled the cursor in the computer screen and played a video game and got her the reward. And the rest is history now.
And it didn't matter where the robotic arm was. She didn't have to see it. She could just see the results.
Absolutely, yeah. If she saw the cursor moving in the right direction and she found the target that she was supposed to find and got a juice reward, the robotic arm could be on the surface of Mars, you know. In fact, a few years later, the robotic device was across the planet and it still worked perfectly, wow, you know, without any problems. Yeah.
How do these BMIs, these brain-machine interfaces that you use in your research work?
They are much simpler than we think. They basically operate by reading the combined electrical activity of a sample of brain cells that are recorded. You know, these signals are recorded by hair-like filaments, the diameter of a hair, a single hair. So you have tens or hundreds of those that can be implanted a few millimeters deep into the brain. And they work as sensors. They detect these electrical signals. So the BMI, what it does is to record these raw signals. We call them spatial-temporal patterns of brain activity. And then, using mathematical models, combine this activity in particular ways so that we can extract the motor commands that are embedded in these patterns that the brain created. Because, as you know, the brain is creating activity that is going to produce behaviors in the future, half a second in the future. So we have to operate in that window of time. We have to extract these motor commands, transform them in digital signals, and then broadcast them to an artificial actuator that will generate the movements that that particular brain is willing to produce. So we are enacting the voluntary motor will of a brain in an artificial device.
I don't think you write about this, but I'm curious because I think everybody who's listening will wonder, can you record the activity of the brain and make the arm move again without Aurora's participation?
Oh, yeah. We actually download that and store it. So we could play it offline. Sure. And we now recently, more recently, discovered that we can send messages back to the brain. And we can establish a dialogue, a bidirectional dialogue between the brain and the device. And that's the reason the title of that chapter is Freeing Aurora's Brain, because I literally really believe that we are starting to free the brain from the physical constraints of the body. Really.
Well, and this changes everything when you think about it. A robotic arm that does not give you feedback means that you would not know automatically how hard you were squeezing a ball, for instance. But the feedback lets you have the same kind of information you get from your fingers, I suppose.
Yeah, that's essential, exactly. That's the type of tactile and proprioceptive feedback that we are starting to produce and send back directly to the brain, because we don't send this through the skin or to the surface of the body or to any tendon or muscle. No, we send these signals now translated into electrical messages back directly to the brain tissue. What we realize is that a monkey can control a body avatar in a virtual world. And as that avatar encounters a virtual object that has some kind of texture, information about that texture can be transmitted instantaneously back to the brain of the subject, and the animal will perceive what it is that it's touching.
What kinds of things do you see happening now? I know you have done some work with what you call exoskeletons, membrane-like machines that patients can use and activate.
Yes, that's what we are working actually at this very moment. We have formed an international, a non-profit international consortium to try to make a quadriplegic patient regain full body mobility by first wearing a full body robotic suit, as you said, an exoskeleton that will allow this patient to move again, both upper and lower limbs, locomote and do most of the basic motor behaviors just by thinking. Just by using his or her own voluntary motor thoughts that will be translated into the commands required for this exoskeleton to carry the patient's body into the world again.
Miguel Nicolelis is the author of Beyond Boundaries, the new neuroscience of connecting brains with machines and how it will change our lives. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 410A, Brain Power. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.